This is the extended podcast of New Classical Tracks from American Public Media. I'm Julie Amacher. In this episode, you're hearing from Norwegian violinist Bjarte Eika. His new recording is called The Alehouse Sessions, and one of the things he'll tell you about is the birth of Western public concerts. You know where it started? In the pubs of England. Enjoy.
Hi, I'm Bjarte Eike. I'm a Norwegian violinist who has specialized in music from the Baroque period, something that I have been doing for about 25 years now. I run my own ensemble, which is called Baroque Solistene, and we have created different types of projects, or I like to call them creative rooms, where we can step in and refurbish, put in new repertory, and change the tapestry every now and then. I like to combine storytelling, performing, and music making when I'm on stage.
Now, we'll talk about a couple of those creative rooms, but first of all, I was noticing that you're also involved in some operas, and most recently, you're the ensemble in residence at the Bergen National Opera. What does that entail?
The last thing we did in Bergen was a staged performance of the Handel Messiah we did for the big festival in Bergen. It was my ensemble, Baroque Solistene, in the pit, and I was directing the whole thing, partly playing the violin and partly conducting. Yes, and we did four performances in Bergen. It was a big success. And every now and then, I mean, maybe once a year we do similar sort of productions, either in the Oslo Opera, where the last thing we did there was the Alcina by Handel, with a fantastic American singer called Nicole Heaston in the leading role. And next year we're doing some Purcell Opera, I think.
Well, there's also a little bit of Purcell involved in the Alehouse Sessions, which you actually started 10 years ago, and you found out pretty quickly that you had a big hit on your hands with that as well.
Yes, it started as a part of a festival that I was involved in running in Norway, and we had different themes every year, and in 2007 we had London as the theme. So we did various concerts with English Baroque music, one could say, or things that were popular in London at different times. Dowland and Handel and Corelli and these kind of things. But then I also felt that I needed to do one bit more informal pub concert, because pubs are such an important thing in the English culture. And I started finding I started doing some research into some of these old collections that I have with simple dance melodies. The English Dancing Master, John Playford, which was released, I think, or printed first time in 1651. My background is mixed of classical and also folk music, so I like to do a bit of session playing and this kind of thing. So it was a sort of perfect mix for me to start digging into this repertory, and then I soon found out that I have to make my own arrangements of them, because there's often very simple melodies without any harmonies or just a title maybe. This project was quite popular instantly with audiences, so I felt that I wanted to develop it. And I've kept it a very much a live thing, because I have all these fantastic characters on stage with me that have so many wonderful things to contribute with. So we have developed a kind of working environment which is very unique, I think, at least in the classical world, where we sort of meet for private workshops. And we have dancing lessons with Stephen Player, who's my dancer and performer in this project. We have percussion lessons or learning drum patterns from Helge Nordbakken, who's my percussion player. We all sing in harmony, led by Thomas Guthrie, who's then our singer.
For 'tis he who will not marry, marry me, shall never taste of joy. Sing, sing, the Cape's in view, and forward, my brave boys.
That's one thing And we like to use a lot of improvisation and try to mix in this hybrid world of classical and folk and maybe even own compositions. And in that way, we create our own quite unique or at least very personal arrangements of different tunes and songs. And and then you end up having some favorites, and you like to work more with them and develop them further, and others you throw away, and you end up with a you build up a large repertory. So we have hours and hours and hours of music now that we can present. And I like to keep it very much a live thing, because the communication with the audience is very important, and the communication on stage. We don't have any music stands. We talk a lot with the audience. We make them sing and these kind of things.
Sing, sing, the Cape's in view, and forward, my brave boys.
So I was very careful about making a recording for a long time. But now it's been 10 years, and it was sort of a good time to make a little to put a finger in the ground and see where the project is as of now, and then try to present what I would like to call the soundtrack to the film. And so it's a representation of the project, with a mix of the different worlds that we like to work with. But it still is a very much a live performance. My main thing in life is to present music live on stage, because then you create a time or a moment in time where we're all together in something unique and special, and that includes the audience, obviously. And it's not something you can just go home and recreate on a stereo or listen on the radio.
So I know that one of your goals with your Baroque ensemble is to make sure that you're bringing music that is relevant to your audiences and to the listeners. And I would imagine that that has a lot to do with it, making sure that that experience is unique and in the moment.
Yes, I also I'm very conscious about not doing it into a fixed show. So that means that when we do it live, it's always going to be different. I just came home today from a tour in Germany, and we did four concerts, and they were all very different. I like to do that. I come to the venue, become inspired by it, what it looks like. We try out, and then we have a little sound check, and I say, let's try this out, that out, and then we go and eat something. And then half an hour before the concert, we all meet, and then I give them the set list of the day. And then I sometimes even change that on stage. But and then we feed off the response from the audience, depending on in which direction we want to go, whether we want to do it more theatrical, more sober, or a mix of it, if you want.
Well, and there's certainly a mix of it on this recording, the Alehouse Sessions. How did you decide, how did you determine the order in which the pieces would appear on this recording then?
Yes, it was a long process, I can tell you that. We had recorded quite a lot, and I liked to keep it in one take, everything. So if we did one take of the curtain tune, then we did that maybe five times, and then I picked the best one. Some of our favorite live tunes we couldn't include on the disc because they involve a lot of dancing and interaction and these kind of things. And I wanted to make and be very conscious about to make a solid album that deserves to be listened to and enjoyed because there is some fantastic music from that time.
Well, I do want to talk specifically about the sea shanties and some of the other pieces, but first I think it's important to have a little historical context because this is all set around 17th century England, and the music scene was really interesting, and I was really fascinated as I was reading more about even the difference between the inns, the taverns, and the alehouses. Share more about that with us so that we can have a better understanding of the unique aspects of these places.
In the middle of the 17th century, when Oliver Cromwell came to power, England was very occupied in civil war and didn't have any money, basically. And he was a Puritan, so he closed down all the theatres and the places where music were made, and he fired all the royal actors and singers and players. He didn't care very much for music. Of course, some of the musicians went to war, and then others, they went maybe to the noble people to teach music, but most of them were just roaming the streets of England, especially London, without any work, unemployed. So they went into the places where people were, and that was in the public houses. And you have this difference between the alehouse, the tavern, and the inn, where you can almost see that the alehouse is for everybody and maybe more popular among the bottom end of the hierarchy, and the tavern is maybe a bit more for the intellectuals. They are drinking a lot of wine there, and then the inns are for lawyers and the richer people. Then, of course, when all these unemployed musicians started coming into the pubs and joining in with the locals and creating these alehouse sessions, the level of the music making rose to high standards, and these sessions became very popular. And after a while, and this was then after Cromwell was beheaded and Charles II was back in power, and music was very much in fashion in London, these alehouse sessions still continued, and they started selling tickets, and there were subscriptions to them, and many of these taverns became music houses where you could find small theatres or opera performances or concerts. So it's the birth of the whole Western music. Public concert happened in pubs in London. It's 50 years before you see the coffee houses in Leipzig with Café Zimmermann and Bach and Telemann. This music that you find in these public houses is very much a mix of bawdy songs and drinking songs and sea shanties. Maybe not, it wasn't called shanties then, but there was a lot of sailors singing working songs. And people like Henry Purcell became very inspired by these places, and he attended a lot of these concerts, and he had this fantastic ability to write genius music, whether it was for a rough pub setting or the Westminster or a theatre. So I think it's this mix of high and low and folk and composed music that is so attractive to me.
I think, too, it was interesting to read about this and how flexible the musicians had to be at the time, because they were all freelancers, right? So one minute they'd be playing an opera, the next minute they'd be, you know, booked at an alehouse, and they were kind of literally running from one gig to the next, of course, making very little money. But it made me think that, well, you're kind of doing this. You're doing opera, you're doing all these different styles, and it's not that different in terms of the, you know, what you're doing as a musician. Hopefully you're making more money, but...
It's very similar. I think it's an interesting comparison between what happened 300 years ago, or four even, and now.
And it's also fascinating, and I think maybe this is something that you made note of, is how no matter what was done to censor the music, it still prevailed.
Yes. So in 1657, I think it was Oliver Cromwell, he even, because of this public concerts in the drinking houses became so popular, he tried everything to prohibit them. He even made a new law saying that if anybody was found playing an instrument or trying to impose their music on the guests in a tavern or a public house, they would be arrested. And then you have the actor's complaint, where some actors are writing that before we used to, in the early days, we used to make money, and we would never step into a public house for less than 20 shillings, and now we have to go around and begging almost for some rich person to throw them a coin while they were playing. And then they were walking around in the streets with their instruments hidden under their cloaks, so they tried to hide their instruments so they wouldn't be arrested. But of course, then people then just started to sing much more, because music will always survive.
Well, let's talk about some of the tunes that are found on the Alehouse Sessions recordings. You said you have some of your favorites. Would you like to point those out?
Well, they sort of tend to change. One day it's maybe the Lead Me, because it sort of encaptures the whole project in one track, because it's an aria by Henry Purcell that we then do some improvisation on in the middle, and then we add a tune from this English dancing master, which is called Italian Rant. And one of my musicians is then doing his Eastern European type of singing on top of it. So it's, and then it goes back into our own arrangement of Purcell's as a male chorus at the end. So it sort of has a lot of the elements that we do. But then I also like the Virgin Queen set quite a lot. I always love to play that because it's groovy and cool. And the curtain tune is fantastic as well. It's a composition by Henry Purcell that we haven't altered anything, but we do it in our style, and it's a bit more swing or rock orientated than most versions you would find of that particular tune. but it's just, it has such a fantastic bass line that just goes on and on and on.
What have you learned about yourself in creating this project?
I think to be humble and really appreciative towards the richness and extreme source of inspiration that is found in each of the individuals in the band. Because it's genre breaking, or it's stepping out of comfort zones. It's a very important thing. And to develop a trust in that the ideas I have myself are valid, but also to be completely astounded by the level of music making that happens every single time we get on the stage.
You've been listening to the extended podcast of New Classical Tracks with Bjarte Eika and Barak Salisten. The Alehouse Sessions is the new recording. From American Public Media,